Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is Joe Hagan. I'm here with Emily Jane Fox. Emily, I'm very excited today.
I've been eagerly anticipating this day.
We're pioneering some new direction here at Inside the Hive. We're going to try something new. I think our listeners and Americans deserve the occasional reprieve from the onslaught of news. And this week we've got John Batiste, the band leader from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Everybody kind of knows him by sight. He's like, you know, incredibly jovial and optimistic, and he's a preternaturally gifted musician, and he's a jazz guy. But I decided to interview him because he's got so much going on. He just won a Golden Globe for his work on the Pixar movie Soul, and he's been nominated for 2 Grammys for 2 separate records that he's on, and he has a brand new record coming out on March 19th. And I figured this is a good time to get to know him. And as it turns out, that was a great idea because, like a lot of people, he was really catalyzed and energized by what has happened in the last year politically, especially the Black Lives Matter movement, which he turns out he had a lot of participation in. And this new album he has coming out was in part catalyzed by all of that. So we had this great conversation about his life and times, which are he's only 34 years old. He's got a prodigy like profile, which on one level is annoying, and on the other hand, couldn't ask for anything more because he's so gifted. And he's gonna play a little piano for our listeners, and it's cool. I think he'll dig it.
What's cool about this interview is he is everywhere right now. He is working on the coolest stuff. He is being recognized in award show after award show. And he has had a lot to say about the world we are living in and where we want to see the world that we're living in. But the very cool part of this is you're not just talking to him and hearing from him. You are listening to him play music as you guys talk.
Right. He comes in and he explains bits and parts about his biography, and we have a whole segment where we geek out about Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk, who are big heroes of his, and he plays some of them on his piano. And we are also going to hear some clips from his new record, so you can hear what his new music sounds like, which is more like almost like a Stevie Wonder soul record. And it's fabulous, and I think people are going to really dig it. And just as an aside, a funny thing that came up in our conversation, as you'll hear in a minute, you know, Radhika Jones, the editor of Vanity Fair magazine, I'm not sure how many people are aware of this, but her father was kind of a figure in the jazz world in the 60s and 70s. He worked for the Newport Jazz Festival, and he was the road manager for Duke Ellington. And it turns out that John Batiste knows him, and there's a whole kind of fun sequence in here where he geeks out on Vanity Fair. He loves Vanity Fair. Without further ado,
let's get to it. I think that this is sort of like, you know, when a sitcom does a musical episode sort of out of nowhere and it's delightful and fun and totally different. That's where we are right now. So let's get on with the show.
Here we go.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new 3-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
Hey, how was the jam?
Wonderful.
What are you rehearsing for?
The Late Show.
Is that The Late Show with Stephen Colbert?
Yep, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
What are you playing tonight?
I don't even know what we're playing yet. I probably will decide in the moment that I play it.
I was looking, maybe it was on Twitter, you responded to somebody's asking about a song you played one night, and it was Such Sweet Thunder.
Yes.
By Duke Ellington.
Yep, Duke. You know, that was actually Billy Strayhorn, his compatriot, the one who he said they had their brain waves in each other's heads.
Wow.
Yeah, that was him.
So allow me to welcome you formally, John Batiste, to Inside the Hive. It's so great to have you here. Congratulations on your Golden Globe for your work on the Pixar film Soul and 2 Grammy nominations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Nominated for 2 Grammys. One is Chronology of a Dream, which is live at the Village Vanguard.
That's right.
And one for Meditations is a collaboration with Corey Wong, who plays guitar. Beautiful record. Very different records. Kind of wonderful to get nominated for 2 extremely different sounding records.
Yeah, the music to me is all about how you feel. And every day we go through different emotional phases, and being able to capture that in these musical expressions is a very, very wonderful thing to be acknowledged for. I'm so grateful.
Yeah. When I listened to the Village Vanguard record that you made, you know, we were not able to be in a live music setting this year like that. And so it's both everything you wish you could be in, and then you actually are in it when you're listening to it. But it made me think it's got to be difficult for a guy like you who likes to play live and likes to be in front of people and do your thing, not to have been able to do that in the last year.
Well, you know, I find energy from being live and playing for people and being amongst folks. And I also find a great deal of energy from being alone. And I think that's really been the silver lining, if there's any way of calling it that, of this pandemic.
We have to improvise. Improvising is what we're doing.
That's right.
Oh, man, there's that little tinkle that the Duke does. I loved reading that when you made the music for Soul, Pixar film, that they brought in like 80 GoPro cameras to aim at your playing so they could make the animated version. And watching that movie with my kids, which was a beautiful thing, it was so evident that they did it right. You know? Yeah, it was really beautiful looking. And obviously it must have been pretty wild for you to look at, to see the spirit of your hands turned into that.
Well, that embodiment in the character is very, very interesting to see that they could pull it off mutually, obviously, but just beyond that, the essence of a person being in a character, that's powerful stuff to be able to do. It's really a craft.
Yeah, just the whole spirit of the point of the movie about jazzing in your life is something that I think a lot of people could probably relate to. You know, we're all sort of in an improvisatory mode in the last year. And, you know, your new record that you have coming out, We Are, seems like, I've been listening to it for the last week. It's fantastic. And it really seemed designed for these times. And in that it's just full of kind of joy, optimism, but also consciousness and a sense of trying to find out who you are in this like uncertain time, you know? And for you especially, it's really interesting because, you come from the jazz world, the New Orleans world, but you're really like pushing out into other sounds and reaching out to a wider audience in a way that seems necessary, you know, trying to find some connection in your sound as well.
Yes. Sound is important. That's everything, man. The sound, that's who we are.
The album starts with the song called Adulthood. And Maybe you could talk to me a little bit about the sequencing of this record and how you thought of it, because I've read somewhere that it's been long in the making, right? And the events of the last year kind of catalyzed it, but it's sort of biographical in some ways. It's a little bit exploring who your own growth and you're turning into a man and coming aware of who you are, right?
Yes, the album is, it started in 2019, August 2019. Spent 2014 into 2019 thinking about it, listening to things, writing things, painting, dancing, all these different ways of experimenting with what this sound would be. And then in 2019, I spent 6 days in my dressing room building the blueprint of it with a few different creatives. We started doing these things where, you know, I'd have an idea, someone else have an idea, we'd put it all together, and I would leave and I would go on set and I would record something, film something. I was working on the score for Soul. I was doing a play about Jean-Michel Basquiat. I was doing all these different things at the same time. And I would have people coming in, food deliveries coming in, the drum set set up in the shower, the piano set up in there, the microphone set up in there. Around the clock for 6 days, we did the blueprint of the record. And then for 9 months, it was the build out of that blueprint and adding songs, collaborating with over 200 musicians and black icons, you know, Quincy Jones, the great Mavis Staples, the author, novelist, Zadie Smith. So many people, James Gadson, legendary drummer, another legendary drummer, Steve Jordan. I mean, you know, folks who are really, really impactful on my life and just on the history and trajectory of black music and black culture. And the real goal was over the 9 months leading into the culmination of this album being complete. It was to be meticulous about how I was putting these sounds together, because I don't really believe in genres. You know, genres are just these constructs that we've created to sell music to people. And really, music comes from communities and it comes from life experience and it comes from individuals, and there's no name for it. So I guess I would call the genre of this album, it's just black pop music, going back into the past and taking things like a musical archaeologist, digging up sounds of folk music, sounds of jazz, sounds of blues, sounds of spirituals and gospel music, sounds of R&B, and making them anew. And that's really the whole idea behind what I was doing. As a person, obviously, as a black artist from the South, but also just as a person, as a human being, identity is important. It's not about exclusion. It's just about defining identity under the umbrella of being a human being. Genre really reduces that. It's very reductive to call something a genre of something.
Yeah. Well, back to Duke Ellington, his famous quote, you know, there's two kinds of music, the good kind and the other kind.
That's it.
And you got a song on here, it's one of my favorites actually on the record, Show Me the Way, which sort of touches on all these different influences and people that you love, from Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Wu-Tang Clan, Beatles, and you have this wonderful line, and Thelonious on the phone with us. Zadie Smith's on that too. What is she doing on that song?
We sing a lot of duets together, and her and Lady Rizzo, a friend of ours, the three of us would jump on Zoom throughout this pandemic. A few times we've gotten a chance to do that and sing songs and play. And you know, there's a lag on Zoom, but we're able to overcome it if we have good internet connection, good enough.
Yeah,
you know, it's a way for us to connect and to kind of have a moment of relief in the communal aspect of singing. And that just sort of bled over into the creation of this album. We were doing that at the time that I was finishing the album up, because I finished the album up at the height of the first wave of the pandemic and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter protests, which I was a leader of in New York City. So, you know, there was all this stuff that's going on that filtered into the record. And those singing sessions with Zadie was one of those things that filtered into the record.
Yeah.
So it's all You know, I said there are 200 plus musicians that I worked with on this record, but every single one of them, and it's not just musicians, it's writers, engineers, all these people, and all of the people, every one of them has some level of great significance in my life, in my coming of age to being 33 when I made this record. I can tell you a story that significantly shaped me that involves each one of these people that I collaborated with on this record.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the protests last summer. You can really feel that theme in this album. It's across a lot of different songs. Obviously had a huge impact on you, and it gave you, obviously some purpose in kind of, focusing the spirit of some of these songs. And how did that come about that you decided, in the past had sort of led these great street music marches, these love riots, as you described them. Mm-hmm. But now you're taking it into a new venue with a different purpose and a different vibe. Like, maybe you can just take me into the moment where you're like, you decided I'm going to do this, and what you were feeling at that time.
Well, I think that as people, we have to hold ourselves accountable to the things that we profess to believe. And oftentimes artists who have this public platform and have a stage to present their values through their work profess to be one way or the other. But then when it comes to putting themselves to the test in the moment of trial, they don't show up. And as someone who has been doing love riots, as you say, these musical processionals that we've become known for around New York and then eventually going around the world and bringing love, joy, and community with us through musical virtuosity always, but mainly being a vehicle, the band Stay Human being this vehicle for merriment and joy and love and community. To really look at that as my philosophy for the last 10 years, and then for a time when the world needs that more than ever, and the city that I'm in needs that more than ever, to not show up and to have all these things going on, and I'm looking at the news and I'm not seeing musicians, I'm not seeing artists, I'm not seeing people show up who are the joy bringers and the truth tellers and professing to be these things. I didn't have to think about it. It was just a test of my mettle. Am I really about what I say I'm about? And if I am, then I would be out there, even though obviously I have all these things on the line, at the time we didn't know where the chips would fall in terms of, where the big networks and where all of the big companies would fall on the side of this argument, this political discussion, if you want to that. But being a part of a CBS show and having all these things happening in my life and being connected to all of these entities, and also the danger of going out there in the first wave of the pandemic and the police brutality that happened the day before we went out there, in the same spot that we started our march, all these things in hindsight were very, very, very dangerous for me on a number of levels. But I'm glad that I didn't actually think it through that much. It was more just, am I about what I said I've been about for the last decade as an artist? And if I am, then I would be out there. And I was out there.
Yeah, it was an uncertain time. I mean, did you feel like you had to check in with The Late Show and tell them you were doing this? Was it a feeling like I'm taking a risk here?
It was a risk. There was not really time to think or check in with anyone in particular, because, these things, as you remember, happened so rapidly. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, the Amy Cooper incident in Central Park, all of the pandemic and the ravishing of the lower class communities, and the political discourse that had been toxic for the last 4 years leading up to that. So much of what we had been dealing with in terms of the police brutality and corrupt policing in inner cities, and that compounding upon itself into a moment of protest around the world. I didn't think that it was something that was going to slow down even at that moment. And it was just really a choice in the moment, the day of, the night before, really, to say, are we going to put this together and bring some of what it is that we do to the table to help point to truth and light.
You have a song on this album called Cry, and the lyrics are, how are you going to fight? Who will you fight to make it all right? And why sometimes does it feel like all I want to do is cry? That really hit me. I was listening to that just this afternoon and was like, wow, that's really the heart of it right there, right?
That's part of our humanity. You know, I think we get caught up in these ideas of race and these ideas of what we are, and our identity is really something much more profound, and it's shared. If you study the human genome, we're 99.9% the same.
Yeah.
And this idea that we can cry together and we can understand the pain that Black people have gone through collectively without losing our identity is truly something that we were out there trying to speak to. We're saying these names, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, we're saying Black Lives Matter. We're saying all these things as an affirmation of the humanity that we all share, that is the truth of who we are, that is not always reflected in the actions and in the policies that govern us. And it's just a simple thing if you look at it for what it is. We're all human beings and we're actually more alike than we are different. And this struggle that we're dealing with is not as much about race as it is about money and power. Mm-hmm. So the money and the power are more the thing that is pulling us apart. And at times it's so above our head and above our level of resource that it feels like all you want to do sometimes is cry for the struggle of the immigrant, for the wrongful imprisonment, for the loss of the innocence. That's the lyrics. You see, that's what we're dealing with.
Listening to this record, you know, you'll have to forgive me. Before all of this happened and before I heard this record, I always thought of you as a conscious person, but I didn't think you as political per se. You know, you're on The Late Show. It's sort of got a universal appeal. What's been your personal experience of racism? I mean, you're from the South. You're from New Orleans. You come to New York. You've been around the world. But what's been your personal experience of it in this country?
I find that racism is something that can be experienced by just living as a Black person. And it's not necessarily something that I consider myself to be a victim of. I don't think of myself as a victim at all, but I do think that racism is the perception of somebody based upon their race and not by their character. And that has happened to me many times simply by being someone who is in a cultural milieu that is outside of that which the people who inhabit that space are used to. And what that does is it creates these moments of assessment of who you are based upon a lack of information. As a Black kid, 17 years old at Juilliard, 16, 17, going into Carnegie Hall or going into X venue trying to present my composition, my symphony. They've never seen a kid like me before that wants to do this, or they've never seen somebody who talks like me or has the swag that I have, or the way that I am is not something that they're used to. And the media has presented them with portrayals of Black people that are very limited. And the media has presented them with these derogatory perceptions of Black people, I will say. And then that is coupled with their lack of meaningful relationships with people like me in their formative years. So if you don't have any of these things in your experience, you'll perceive me based on a perception of race and a perception of class. And that to me is a daily occurrence for a non-famous Black person. Because if I'm famous and I'm Black, then you've seen me on television or heard my records, and you know what I'm about, and you know that I have some deal of money or some deal of success or wealth. So so you understand the class and race space that I inhabit from a different perspective than what most of my life before being famous and having money was. So it's not even really an occurrence. Obviously, I've been called the N-word. I've been called many things. I've experienced that explicit racism, but it's nowhere near what our ancestors and my grandfather, who was a protest, he's an activist. It's nowhere near what they experience on a regular basis. Although at times it's just as intense as we saw with George Floyd and Breonna.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a daily occurrence, I'll say.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, let's talk about your grandfather. What you just mentioned, you've got a song that on the album called Boyhood, and you're sort of talking about your memories of growing up, which is really a sweet song. It's not like it's not as heavy and emotional, not bearing the same weight as like Cry. But you come from this like family, the Batiste family in New Orleans, famous music family, and I've heard the name before. I watched Tremé, right? Wendell Pierce, fantastic actor, playing a Batiste, right, in that TV show. But a lot of people don't know about this family. And maybe you can tell me a little bit about what's the sort of genealogy of the Batiste family in Louisiana, and then tell me about your grandfather. So like, who was the first musical Batiste that was known, for instance?
So my grandfather, who is on the record, is actually my mother's father, David Gaucher, who's an elder in the AME church and is someone who has been an activist since the time of the Memphis sanitation strike during the Martin Luther King Jr. era. Dr. Martin Luther King was basically speaking for the rights of Black sanitation workers. And at this time, my grandfather was the head of the hotel workers union in New Orleans. And as well as the postal workers union at sometime after that, around that time. And he's also someone who fought for our country, and everyone in my family going back 4 or 5 generations. I mean, even further, actually, if I think about it, has fought in every war that this country has had. So speaking about my lineage and understanding that, we also come from a line of farmers on both sides of my family. And Black farmers, farm families in the South, in Georgia, Clayton County, Georgia, and then in Mississippi, as well as obviously Louisiana. So there's that in my lineage. There's also the Creole Louisiana genetic code, which I learned from Henry Louis Gates on this show. Which means that, you know, there's a diversity to our line, our bloodline, and there's a cultural diversity that I think is truly American. And I think about my family as being a truly exemplar of what it means to be an American. To have somebody in my line, 7 lines before me, that's just come out of slavery and Reconstruction, and then for me to be in New York City in the position I am in society and to have the opportunities that I have, that's the American dream manifest. So I just find that we have so much culture embedded in my family. And obviously the Batiste side of the family has many different musical manifestations. My father was my first musical mentor. The late, great Alvin Batiste was an avant-garde clarinetist who played with Ray Charles as well. Started a band with Ellis Marsalis, brought avant-garde and contemporary jazz to the New Orleans scene. Harold Batiste, producer extraordinaire. Russell Batiste, Funky Meters, drummer. So many different styles of music. It there actually is a movie in there that I should make at some point.
Yeah. Well, then tell me what it was like growing up in your house as a kid. I mean, you're surrounded by lots of music. I mean,
yes.
What would we have heard in the Batiste living room, you know, let's say 30 years ago when you were a kid?
Man, so like, was it? Clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hand played the tambourine so well. That would play all the time. That, Donnie Hathaway, Professor Longhair and James Booker, Clarence Carter, many, many styles of Black social music. Music that you hear at cookouts, music that you would hear in social gatherings in New Orleans, and just contemporary Black social music. And that would be playing a lot in the house. And also I would experience that in person. You know, there were many ways that I was exposed to music as a performer at an early age. I would sing and dance and you know, my father and his brothers, they had the band together that would play back in the Chitlin Circuit days with a lot of the R&B and blues performers, talking about King Floyd, Jackie Wilson, you know, stuff that you would see in a juke joint on a movie. They have stories right. like that. So, you know, I would hear the stories. I would see the music. I would hear the music on recordings, obviously, in the house. And eventually I would be playing in clubs. Way before I was old enough to be actually in the club, you know, I'd be playing in the Maple Leaf Bar, for instance, you know, back when I was a preteen. And then by the time I was 13, 14, Trombone Shorty and I started a band, and we would play in the Maple Leaf Bar every Tuesday or Wednesday night. And this would be after we go to school, we go walk to the Maple Leaf on Oak Street and play the gig until 1 a.m., go back home. And get up for school in the morning. So, you know, that's what it was like growing up for me.
What would we have heard in the Maple Leaf?
I mean, everything from the New Orleans canon. You talk about stuff that we all learned. But then we started really composing our own music. By the time I was 15, I started leading my own bands. And my first record was when I was 17, entitled Times in New Orleans, that kind of captures the kind of original music that I was writing at the time. Which, you know, it was original music that was rooted in this kind of Afro-Caribbean sound, you know, like so, and or we had one, so like things like themes like that I would write in class, or I would write on the way to the gig, or we'd even play stuff and it would spontaneously happen on the performance stage where we would make music on the spot. But it would mainly be us trying to explore our voice with all of the sounds and rhythms of what we had heard growing up, trying to find our voice in that.
And then when you're in high school, I see you and Stephen Colbert made a great little video series where you guys went down to New Orleans and you sort of took them on the tour, you know, and we met the teacher that was your piano teacher in high school, right? Who kind of probably expanded your horizons probably as wide as they could go at that time, right? You know, when you're 17, 18, before you go to Juilliard, what did you think of yourself as wanting to be musically? Like, what were you into?
I was into jazz, in particular jazz that was very, very trio oriented. When I say trio, you think about the great jazz trios, Ahmad Jamal, Bill Evans, John Lewis, trio pianists who would create compositions and arrangements, Oscar Peterson, you know, just creating these kind of worlds between the piano, the bass, and the drums. And I was very interested in going to New York and pursuing that and trying to be a, trying to make the best jazz trio that I could. And that eventually evolved into being a band that had a front line of horn players. Then that eventually evolved into being a big band. And then I eventually evolved into a band that I called the social music band, which was the idea that genres doesn't exist. And that was the first idea that I had about bringing Stay Human to the forefront. And then I crafted Stay Human. And then the band has gone through seven evolutions into what it's become.
You know, one of the facts that I saw in an interview that really kind of, it was interesting to me, is when you got to Juilliard, of course, New York was like a big, you know, education, right? You're going to get so many more influences. But you told somebody that before you went uptown to Cleopatra's Needle to do a jam session, maybe with Roy Hargrove or somebody that you were getting to know or meet, that you had never heard Monk before. You had never really listened to Monk deeply yet. And but he becomes kind of like a major touchstone for you, right?
Definitely. Thelonious Monk is one of the greatest musicians of the world's history. And he's one of the ones who is still underrated by my account, because he really did change the sound of the piano. And it's very difficult to describe it, but when you hear it, it's so identifiable that you can't replicate it. And no one has really been able to replicate it, which I find to be really fascinating, because the piano is such, you know, it's an inanimate object, and everybody who plays it sounds different. And somehow he sounds the most unique out of most people who have ever played. But coupled with that, he's got a compositional genius and a logic to what he's doing, both as an improviser and as a composer, that struck me when I was, you know, 18, 19, whenever at this jam session. I heard somebody playing his music. And at the time, you know, I'd heard Monk. I'd heard of Monk all of my time studying jazz in high school and all the things that I'd done prior to being in New York. Obviously, Monk had come up and I knew some of his song. I knew his compositions, like Straight No Chaser. I didn't really know. I didn't really hear it. I heard it, but I didn't have ears to hear it. Sometimes you hear something and it's before you are ready to receive it.
Yeah.
And at this night in particular, for whatever reason, hearing Evidence, the song that they were playing is entitled Evidence. And hearing that song, it opened my ear in a way that was so profound that it changed my whole musical scope in that moment. Because the other part of the context that I'll give you is that I was working on something that resembled the type of logic and rhyme of Monk's phrasing. And unbeknownst to me, he had already developed that way of phrasing and way of rhyming musically before I had thought of it. And I thought of it naturally, but I didn't know that it already existed in the world and had been developed. So when I heard that in the time that I was trying to develop this thing, it was so striking that I was like, wait, what is that? That's what I want. That's the thing. That's what I want to go. That's what I want.
Can you show us what that sounds like?
So it's kind of, you know, it's like, so that's the melody. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now that's the melody, and it's got all of this space in it that he's implying what the harmony is. Now, if I was to really play what the harmony is clearly, so you can know exactly what the harmony is without guessing it, it would be. Now, the implication of the harmony is what struck me. The idea that this space is like a question. Huh? That's right. What you say? Uh-huh. Then? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a way of giving your ears something to grab onto, but just enough that you're holding on for what the next thing is. And then when you hear the next thing, then that adds to the narrative of the first thing. And then you can just keep that logic of call and response and tension and release, or tension and more tension and more tension and release, or release, 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 tension. It could be, it's infinite. You can just keep going forever.
Wow. And he's a very percussive player too. And you've played the drums, right? And you know the value of like that to piano playing, actually, because it's really a percussive instrument in some ways, right?
Yeah.
And he gets that. So that's the jazz nerd portion of our interview. But I had to get that in there because I love talking about Monk and Duke Ellington. And thanks for indulging me on that.
No, of course. It's a very percussive. It's just a very black way of playing. Like classical music, I love, obviously, but I think that hearing that kind of mastery and logic with such a percussive black sound that was more akin to where I was coming from anyway, growing up playing on like out of tune pianos and stuff like that and playing in clubs and bars. It resonates with me because that was where I was naturally coming from.
And the stride and the sort of, the kind of rent party jamming style, but taken to an art form.
Yes.
And I don't know if you got that record I sent you.
I did, man. This record is a gift of gifts because this is one of my favorite albums of all time. I'd actually put it in the top 10 of my favorite albums of all time.
I'm so pleased to hear that. And I just had a feeling that that might be true. And we're talking about Duke Ellington's Piano Reflections. I thought about that. It's like a 1953 recording of him playing just in a trio and solo setting, but it's such a deep cut. It's so fantastic of a vision of how great Duke Ellington is as a piano player.
Yeah, he's got a way of playing, you know, when you think about man, Reflections in D or Melancholia, all of them.
Yeah.
There are some meditations on the record that feel so special when you immerse yourself into them that it's a gift to your soul if you let it happen. You got to just put the record on and just immerse yourself into it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say in the last year, which everybody knows has been a difficult year, it's a record that is like a balm, you know.
Mm.
You listen to that record and you can get into a headspace and it feels like you're having a private sesh with the Duke, which is a very magical thing.
Yes, yes. Duke Ellington, I discovered when I was in the library and I was looking for different recordings to be inspired by. I wanted to find something that would inspire me and give me some inspiration as a young student, musician. I must have been 15 or so. And I picked up a Duke Ellington album that was him live at Newport. And he was smiling on the cover. And I remember he had on either a tweed jacket or a seersucker blazer or something like that. Something sophisticated looking situation where I was just really drawn to the cover of the album with him and this font, the Newport. I'd never heard of Newport. What is Newport Jazz Festival Live? And it was a live record and it was the blazer and everything was really, really working in a way that was drawing me in. And I picked the record up, listened to it. Has this, obviously, for jazz aficionados, they know this famous solo that is it's like a 20-minute track. It's a blues solo that goes for several choruses and it just keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter. It's burning through the speakers. by his saxophonist, Paul Gonzalez, on Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue. And, you know, that was the first real experience that I had with Duke, listening to that album. And, of course, over the years, George Wein, who founded the Newport Jazz Festival, and the impresario icon, Papa George, you know, I've become friends with George and a mentor just in this business. He's been a mentor for me. You know, I've always been a part of the Newport festivals in some way since 2012, 2013. So, you know, full circle, my discovery of Duke and meeting people who knew him like George and talking about his life and stories that they can tell about him and his daughter, Mercedes, and different folks who I've had the honor of getting to know since that first library experience has deepened my understanding of who he was. There's a great book I recommend for people to listen if you want to know about Duke. There's a lot of great recordings, obviously, but if you read this book by Stanley Dance, who followed Duke around for many years, Duke and Stanley have it's a great book where he you get to hear Duke's voice. I think you got to hear Duke talk.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
yeah. And Stanley Dance was sort of his, you know, Boswell, or, you know, he was his, he wrote all of his words down, and then it's all in the voice of Duke. And
it's all in Duke's voice, and it feels like you're hanging with Duke.
That's right. And that's special. That's a special place to be. Just a little aside that you'll appreciate, the editor of Vanity Fair, Radhika Jones.
Yes, yes.
Her father was Bob Jones, right?
Bob Jones. Yes, yes.
It is Bob Jones.
It is Bob Jones. Yes, yes. Radhika's incredible. She's so elegant and amazing. And I've run into her sister actually at the Jazz Festival in New Orleans a lot of times. But just before we go, the World of Duke Ellington is the name of the book. I remember now.
That's
but,
right.
But Radhika is so special. You know, I love Bob obviously as well. And I think that we really have this cool thing going on right now in culture that Vanity Fair is really positioned well to take advantage of, which is the kind of fashion, music, cosmopolitan aspect of life and the way that those things have always been central to each other. And you think about jazz and black music and what that really means, what that means culturally from a cultural perspective and how to speak to that. You know, there's a lot of cool things that can be done in this time.
Well, I think that you, in your career and in the platform you have on The Late Show, it's really one of the biggest platforms for jazz in the country. And it's like, in a way, you're an ambassador for it. And let's be honest, you know, jazz is not something everybody can wrap their heads around. It can intimidate some people, or they don't totally get it. And it's like a whole, you know, but the ways in which you, on your new album, for instance, and some of the other records you made, are able to kind of connect it more broadly, you know, break out of the genre and to the degree the genre matters anymore, right? That's a way to like connect people with it. And it also, though, I think it's really the time for people to listen to this music really is now more than ever because of the kind of, there's so much diversity in jazz culture. There's so much more, it's got the spirit of improvisation that we're all can relate to right now. It's like, how do you respond to somebody else in a way that's, simpatico and unifying and hits another note or a chord that has a bigger social effect, right? And I think that's what you're about, right?
Definitely. Giving people something that means something.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as an aside, we were talking about Radhika's father. She's going to be amused that we're talking about her on this podcast so much. But her father managed Duke Ellington's tours in the late 60s and the early 70s and the famous Duke Ellington Sacred Concert. Mm-hmm. Of course, her father was there. So was her mother. And I've talked to them and they've got amazing stories about that.
I would love to hear that because those days that was the last decade of his creative output. Sacred concerts and that sacred music. And he was really, really in a space where there's this just this lionized figure musically. Yeah. Listening to him speak in that time, it was just such a potent clarity that he had with a very acute way of expressing complex things and ideas. And he had condensed it to such a clarity at that point in his life. It was very, very special, I imagine, to be a part of that.
Absolutely. We were talking about your time in New York. Yes. Discovered Monk, you were at this jam session at Cleopatra's Needle, but around this time you got to know Roy Hargrove, or you got interested in his music, and he was doing something that really in some ways is a model for you in that he was expanding jazz into other forms, right? In the 90s into like hip hop and neo soul and other things that you're interested in.
Yes, yes. Roy was somebody who I listened to on recordings. D'Angelo's Voodoo, Erykah Badu, many, many different recordings outside of his own. And then, of course, he had his own recordings with the quintets, jazz music, and then he had the RH Factor, which was a fusion of many different flavors, neo-soul. It was just the timing in the early 2000s was really ripe for a reinterpretation of soul and hip hop with jazz and funk and fusion elements. And I listened to a lot of those recordings. I listened to many things during that time that stuck with me. I remember buying several stacks of CDs every other week and just downloading all the information, the liner note information, the musical information, lyrical information, all the stuff, you know, that I could. Led Zeppelin records, I remember getting the greatest hits of many artists who I just didn't even know anything about, but I would look at the cover and I'd want to hear it. Bjork being one of them. Then I ended up buying all her records. Vespertine, one of my favorites of hers. Radiohead at the time. The Michael Jackson records, Dangerous, was the first one that I bought. That cover was, well, him, kind of the circus looking thing with the eyes. So much. Common, like Water for Chocolate, which Roy Hargrove is also on. Hearing Jay Dilla, hearing all that music. So you got to imagine that this is around the time that I'm also studying classical music. I'm also playing video games every single day. And music from the video games, Yoko Shimomura, the Capcom games, and Squaresoft game, Final Fantasy VII, the soundtrack by Nobu Uematsu. So you got all of these Japanese video game composers influencing me, as well as the neo-soul and then the classical music that I'm studying, and then the jazz and all the stuff that I'm playing in the clubs at that time, which is, you know, a mix of all types of different music. Musicians from Cuba coming to New Orleans, musicians from the Caribbean, New Orleans musicians who are playing traditional music, the younger musicians, my peers, and all the musicians coming up playing stuff that's a fusion of all the stuff we're hearing on the radio, which is like the Hot Boys, Master P, No Limit. You know, like Southern rap had this huge explosion at the time. Bounce music, which has mainly been indigenous to New Orleans up until recently. And then we have all of our cultural music of New Orleans. So you can just imagine this explosion of musical influences and sounds and rhythms that at that time when I was just getting into my real intense study of music, I had all these things that I was drawing from.
Wow. So and you know, thinking about the before and after of all that absorbing all that music, you know, you're sort of setting yourself up to be able to go in any direction. And I also wonder like how hearing like a Radiohead record or a Jay Dilla album, I mean, there are phrases and ideas that you can, you know, translate back into jazz, right? I mean, you could go in all different directions from there. I mean, but when you first made your first record, it was a pretty pure jazz record, the live album at the Art Museum. And the first, I think about that record because the first song is very monkish. It's got a real monk feel to it. And it's sort of like your first declaration You know, when you're showing your chops off is that monk spirit, right? Can you play a little section of that possibly?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yes, that's right, that's right.
Remind me of the name of that record.
Sumaira, and that's called Live in New York at the Rubin Museum.
Yeah.
Jonathan Baptiste Trio, Philip King, Joe Saylor. Yeah. We recorded that record in 2005, 2006, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
I was 19, and that was...
Wow.
You know, I think that when you're studying something as a musician, you get immersed in it. But as you get older, you realize that this idea of genre is a construct that kind of limits your creative expression and your flow. So, you know, if I were making a record of what I actually was influenced by in its entirety, in the fullness of it, it would have had many different sounds of music and different styles of things in there. But because I was so immersed into Thelonious Monk at the time, into jazz at the time, and believing that you had to adhere to these rules of genre, I kind of limited the scope of what the record was. And that's not to say that it's a bad thing, because I think that if that's your choice as an artist, then that's great because it's empowered. But I think when you think that you have to limit your choices, that's when it becomes problematic, because you don't know what could have been with your music and with your development. And I think this latest album that I made is the first time that I've really been able to make a record that encompasses full scope of or a broader scope of who I am as an artist and what my color palette is, if you were to liken it to a painter. You know, yeah. if you think you're just making a hip hop record or just making a jazz record, and those colors are red and black, and you only use red and black, then you're limited. Versus if you're just making a human record of human experiences and your cultural understanding and your scope and your vision and whatever comes out, then you have so many colors at your disposal.
Well, you just said exactly what I had been trying to say, so thank you. And it has to do with all those things you were picking up in the stacks of CDs, right? And now it's sort of like you're finally kind of like getting that painting together from all those different influences. And clearly one of them is like Stevie Wonder is very strong in this thing. And I think of him, interestingly, because I feel like in the 70s, he was making music similar to the way that you're doing it. And it kind of like very personal, playing every instrument when he could, but, you know, very singular vision, right?
Yes, yes. He's a true artist. You know, he was somebody who I think is, you know, he calls me on my birthday every year. The last 4 or 5 years, he calls me on my birthday. And it's really a great conversation every time, because it's one of those intention setting conversations. It's like a setting you up for the next year, check-in, to kind of set your focus in a way that I love that. That's in my life. And he's somebody in my life that I can really, you know, for years I listened to his music and was enamored, but now to know him, the person, it's great.
When was the last time you had one of those conversations?
Last birthday.
Yeah.
November 11th. He called me, and it's really, really a monumental thing to have the respect of people like Stevie Wonder and Quincy Jones and Mavis Staples. To me, those are the people that matter the most, because those are the artists, you know, like if Duke were alive, those are the people who, it's only a handful of people who I think when they speak and when they give you any feedback, it's almost inalienable. You just got to accept it. You got to listen to it. That's it.
Yeah.
Boom.
From the mountain.
Yeah.
What was was there a breakthrough for you in terms of realizing that you could just bust out of all these genres and do this album?
I think it's a breakthrough that happened over the course of a decade.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily see it as a breakthrough, more just something that I've always strived to do. Everybody wants to do that. Everybody wants to freely express who they are without any sort of thing, ideology, norm or expectation tethering them to the floor. They want to be able to fly. And I think to fly as an artist is to create something that exists purely and authentically from your experience, and nothing else could be in its place because it's directly from the source. And that's why we don't want to be derivative, not because we don't have influences. Obviously, everyone has influences, but to derive something from something else and for it to be able to be replaced by that thing, or to be a second-rate version of that thing, or to be another version of that thing, just feels more like a trade that belongs in an assembly line and not art.
Yeah, well, it's hard to do because of just the music business, right? And I'm sure one of the breakthroughs for you, I know you talked about you'd been thinking about this record since 2014, at least, getting onto The Late Show, having this bigger platform, having kind of a wider audience to address, you know, probably helped, because if you're just in jazz, it can be a very small audience, right? And they know what they want to hear, right? And so here you have this much wider audience and you can kind of be you have a wider spectrum of conversation, right? That's what all these different, it allows you to use all these different influences you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that when you are in a jazz context or in whatever we call jazz today, because it's not really a real thing.
Right.
But I think that when you're in a space of what we call the jazz world, which is the infrastructure of clubs and festivals and radio stations and things like that, that I have great respect for, but I do have a lot of critique of, which is part of the reason why my path has been what it is. If I always wanted to exist outside of what was prescribed available to us. And I was always wanted to express things that I felt were not really always welcome in the space of that infrastructure and give it to people who I felt like needed it more than the people who were aware of the jazz world. That's why we ended up playing in street corners and in subways. And that's why we ended up playing in so many different types of venues, from, you know, concert halls to clubs to amphitheaters to high school gymnasiums, all of the ways that it used to be, where the music that people played wasn't relegated to a small network of clubs and that's it. And there's a way to play and there's a way to dress and there's a way to be, and only a few outliers, and even the outliers still adhere to the dogma that seems to tether you to a specific mode of artistic expression. Yeah. And I don't buy into anything like that, because I don't think human beings are like that.
I think I read somewhere that you have on the horizon beyond this album, which is, you know, like a pop soul record, something symphonic also that you're working on, like, a large scale composition of some kind. Can you tell me about it?
Yes, it's the idea that I have of bringing the idea of social music, which is all music that has existed as ritual music or communal music. So, you know, every culture has had some form of indigenous music. Native Americans, Black Indians in New Orleans, all of the ways that people have connected in community via music. What would that look like in a symphonic space in the year 2022? So thinking about all of that, I decided to create this piece that's called the American Symphony. And it has four different ensembles. One is a symphony orchestra. The other is a marching band. The other is a chorus. And then the fourth ensemble is what I consider to be a new age rhythm section. And new age meaning it has elements both of the traditional rhythm section of guitar, bass, drums, and piano, as well as technological elements that range from sampling and different forms of sound design and enhancement.
Wow.
So it's several musicians playing this really rich, really dense four movement piece that is kind of a it's kind of a report of where we are musically.
Wow, that sounds insanely ambitious. How long have you been working on that?
Oh, wow. I've been working on it in my mind for a long time. Yeah. And actually, in reality, maybe the last couple of years, we played a few of the movements in reductive, kind of like a reduced orchestral setup. Was that last year, a year and a half ago, before COVID?
Yeah.
It's really a powerful piece to make manifest.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Make it manifest, yep.
Well, I can't wait to hear that. When can we roughly expect to see that emerge in the world?
It'll premiere at Carnegie Hall in 2022, and that will be special as a part of my residency there.
Yeah. Ah, so, wow. That's something to look forward to. I can't wait.
Yes, indeed.
And in the spirit of Duke Ellington, once again, you know, creating suites and hybridizing American black jazz with classical, and it's more of what you're about, right?
That's right.
So thank you for coming on Inside the Hive. I'm really honored that you chose to come on here. Just to close us out here, any chance you can play us a little something? Maybe just whatever you've been playing lately at home. Like, what are you just jamming around on nowadays?
Let's see. I was just playing the from the record.
That's our program this week. I'd like to thank John Batiste for coming on Inside the Hive this week. Thank you to my co-host Emily Jane Fox, producer Brett Fuchs, the people at Cadence 13 who helped make this happen. And if you enjoyed what you heard today, please hit subscribe. Go to Apple or radio.com, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. Please support our sponsors the way they support this program. And we'll see you next week.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.